This is a sound you don't often hear dancers make mid-performance. That is the voice of
Kat Mahari. I'm an artist. Dance is memory, exploration, my meditation on life.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to hear about Kat Mahari's newest project at 34th and Woodland. She's telling her own story. 35th and Woodland. She's telling her own story, a reflection on violence and transcendence through street dance. Kat Mahari, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
What's the story behind this project, the solo mixtape series, Violence Break?
The story behind it has to do with when I was living in London, England, and I was going through cultural miscommunications, personal changes, transformation, and was really contemplating how people can be rude to each other without intentionally meaning to, as well as what does that mean in the larger scheme of things, really inspired by some of my favorite comedians such as Paul Mooney and performance artists such as William Pope L. And I just really recall being in England and dealing with people who thought they were very funny. And I was just like, you guys just got funny in the middle of the 20th century. Nobody thought you were funny before then.
Well, wait. Okay, I want you to take me back to your experiences in England a little bit more. What was it that, what specific kinds of things had you contemplating how people can be rude without meaning to?
Well, I was in graduate school at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. And there is a repartee that the English are known for, particularly those that are of the Anglo-Saxon descendant variety. And I just remember thinking, you
Wait,
guys,
can you tell me what this repartee is like?
It's very, I call it a nasty nice. Like they're trying to be nasty, but they think they're being nice, or they're trying to be nice, but they're actually being nasty, and they know it. And I just remember thinking, you guys have just got funny. You know, as a descendant of African diasporic people who have been in the U.S. for at least over 400 years, I have 400 years of genealogical and socialized training in how to survive based on being nasty nice. So you guys got a lot of work to do.
Well, so what do you, did you have an experience there that really had you feeling like that could demonstrate this a little bit?
Okay. There's so many experiences, and it wasn't just about England. It was also about where I come from, my own personal background, and the different violences that are dealt with if you identify as a woman, if you identify as a Black woman.
Yeah, and I want to hear about some of those too. But yeah, tell me about.
For instance,
yeah.
One time, I was walking up the stairwell of school. And I had a lot of media equipment with me. And at that time, I was feeling unwell, coming down with a really nasty cold. And my mother called me from the States, which is unusual to do because it was expensive, you know. And I didn't have, like, the Skype app on my phone. And so I just put everything down in a corner and just proceed to say, what's up? How are you doing? You know, and this woman comes down the stairwell. This person comes down the stairwell and she's like, oh, do you really think right here is the perfect place for you to be having a conversation? And I was like, neither is at your mama's house, but you still do. You know, it was just like, don't go there. You know, don't think that because you're couching it in these false pleasantries that I don't see the violence that you're trying to enact upon me.
What was it that you were feeling that what was the violence that you were feeling in what she was saying?
Well, if you see somebody stop and have a conversation and you don't know them, who tells you to speak to them? You know, I'm not in the middle of a busy sidewalk in Trocadero, you know, dropping all my things. I'm in a stairwell in a corner. Who are you to talk to me like that? You know, it's just basic things that we say are common sense. But of course, common sense is itself a highly contested ideology.
But you noticed especially the sort of hyper polite terms.
The hyper polite terms. And I said, well, neither is your mama's house. But yet you still go there and talk, you know, you know, so just shut it down. I was going through a lot of, I'm going to have to shut you down real quick. Otherwise, you think we're about to go into some comedy skit, and I am not about to engage with you in a comedy skit because nobody's paying me for my lines.
Going back to, you said that part of this has to do with where you come from. Talk to me about that piece of it, how that fits in.
Well, I think having the being situated within blackness, this racialized context, this racialized, unjust, inequitable frame in the greater social world, global world, you deal with quite a bit of ridiculousness, right, from other humans because they were also raised within the racialized game and they also are committed and are brought up with biases to enforce inequity, injustice, things that we would say on the face of it and just boldly speaking truthfully to it have nothing to do with love and compassion. So I'm quite used to people coming to me incorrectly and then me having to figure out whether or not I'm going to put forth any labor, mental, emotional, or physical, to correct how they're coming to me.
Will you tell me just a little bit more about where you come from and your background?
Yeah, I'm a dancer. My background as a human being.
Yeah.
My mother's name is Shirley Ann O'Brien.
Well, no, I understand the immensity of what I'm asking, but since these are autobiographical dance pieces,
yeah,
and our listeners
semi-autobiographical.
Maybe have never met you, or you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. What do you think it's important for people to know?
I think it's important for people to know that I come from a background within the African and or Kebulon diaspora. I think it's important that people know that I identified with gender of woman. I think it's important for people to understand that I consider street dance the most, particularly U.S.-based street dance, but all dance, but definitely U.S.-based street dance in my experience to be the most avant-garde forms of expression.
Tell me more about street dance, because that's how you've chosen to tell your story.
Well, I can tell you about U.S.-based street dance because I don't know all the street dances in the world, and that in of itself, when we say street dance, we're primarily speaking about things that occur outside of studio systems, correct? And studio systems are typically things that you have to pay for. But of course, just like we live in a world of capitalism, street dance in of itself, you can go to a studio class. I mean, that's been happening since at least the early part of the 20th century. For instance, you have the birth of jazz, and we say the birth of jazz happened in Louisiana. We say it happened in New Orleans. And then within 20 to 30 years of it, it goes up the river, hits New York. And then all of a sudden, we have something called jazz dance, right? And it happens. Jazz dance happens because New York is the center of capitalism. That's why it gets the positionality of saying it's the birth of jazz dance. But I'd be really surprised if people in New Orleans, people who have
dancing to that music.
Yes, you know, and didn't have their own names and codifications, particularly over a 20, 30-year period. So when we're talking about street dance, we're also sort of speaking of issues of racialization. We're speaking of issues of economic immobility, as well as of just the freedom to move, the freedom to create wherever you are. So we're speaking about a lot of different things when we say street dance, but I think those are three of very important parts, you know.
What do you think that when you talk about you wanting to talk about violence and transcendence, mm-hmm. what does U.S.-based street dance, I mean, that has a complicated relationship with mm-hmm. violence, at least in perception.
Absolutely. Well, if you're denied an opportunity to create a work within any kind of institutionalized setting, and you have to go outside and be outside, wherever that outside is, because not every dance is actually created outside. We're just talking about outside institutionalized support.
Yeah. So the street as in not the studio.
Not the institutional studio. Not the dominant paradigm supported studio. Because you can have a studio. There's plenty of artists that have had a room and said, this is the studio. You know what I mean? So when we're talking, what was your question again? I'm sorry.
Let's see.
How does violence and transcendence, well, anytime you have to work outside of something because you've been pushed to the edges, you're enacting and dealing with a form of violence that's being perpetrated upon your ability to be. And that's a key factor of street dance. You know, this I'm going to have to then create or be part of a group of people that are creating a place, a space, time for movement, positivity, productivity. So that has to do with the transcendence of the violence that's enacted upon you.
Do I understand correctly that you trained in boxing as part of your dance training?
Yeah, I trained in boxing. It wasn't really, yeah, I guess it was actually. Right before I went to London, I said, I'm going to start boxing. I don't know why. Actually, I do know why. I was reading this article about this artist named Louis Le Cavalier, who I believe was the first Canadian to win a Bessie Award for dance, which is a New York dance award. And I think she won it in 1981 with Edward Locke. And I was reading that she had injured her hips. And as a form of rehabilitation, she started boxing. So I was like, well, she injured. I'm going to do it before I injure. Otherwise, before then, I didn't really have an overt interest in boxing. And so before I left for London, I was living in Kansas City, had just finished up my first year artist residency with Charlotte Street Foundation. I started looking up boxing studios before I even got there. And when I got there, that's how I got into boxing. I ended up with a wonderful coach named Carlos Marino, who was a national champion of Portugal in his class. And that's how I got into boxing and the beauty of the art of it and its own theater of war and its own theater of transcendence.
I've seen you perform, and your movements, it seems to me that, like, your body and mind both learned something from boxing that is visible, but I can't put my finger on how to describe it. Can you describe it?
Can I describe what I learned from boxing?
Yeah.
I learned, I can't say I learned something that's just so radical, it's about to blow your mind, Gina. But but I can say I gained a deeper appreciation for all forms of movement and their relationship to life itself. I gained a really strong appreciation of being able to respect and have just faith in the intelligence of the body as its own entity. I learned that heavily in boxing, because you get to a point, particularly when you're sparring, you cannot allow the mind, which has its own biases, to come through to the fore, which is not to say that the body doesn't have biases, because we pick up habits all the time, right? But you have to then strengthen the intelligences of the body, and you have to allow the body to do that. And I really was able to get to a place, a better space within myself through boxing.
But thinking about violence and dance, is there a difference between an opponent, which is what you would typically say you have in boxing, and a partner, which is what you would typically say you have in dancing?
One would typically say they have a partner in dancing, and one would typically say they have an opponent in boxing. Well, when you're practicing boxing and when you're, you know, at the gym and you have your coach, even if it's just your sparring partner, there is a dance. In fact, one of my favorite stories from Carlos is when he was training in New York, and he's had a million and one more awesome stories to even share, but how it's a dance. And he was training with an amazing boxer and coach there, and they were just going at it, and they never hit each other because it's a dance. So you have to get into the rhythm and timing. Having an opponent does not necessarily mean having an enemy. It's just like saying you yourself are your own best and worst opponent. Does that mean you yourself are, you just wake up and just punch yourself in the face? No. You know, it's about rhythm and timing. And when you're having a high level opponent or having a high-level partner, just like you want to partner yourself, your rhythm and timing becomes more precise, becomes more beautiful, more organic.
So, is there something that you're hoping people in Kansas City can see differently through the performances you're creating?
Absolutely. I'm hoping that people in Kansas City and worldwide, I'm hoping that people get into a space where they're willing to question their reaction and action towards violence, because violent break definitely positions violence as a totality, as an ontology.
What does that mean?
That means it's something similar to love, meaning we think that love is everywhere and in all things, and same thing with violence.
What makes dance the right tool to talk about that?
Because I'm a dancer.
That makes sense. Can you talk a little bit about your musical collaboration that's a part of this?
Yes. I want to speak about that as well as the movement specifically, because even though Violent Break Volume 1 comes from, was based upon my relationship with boxing and hip hop at the time, this one, which still builds upon my relationship with hip hop dance, also incorporates crump and my experiences with Tai Chi. And I want to give a big shout out to my crump teacher, Quentin Hammonds, an amazing multi-talented artist based in KC who's head of a crump family here called Ghoul. And when it comes to the music, I am so fortunate that my collaborator in this particular iteration of it is an amazing producer and composer based in New York City named Kerwin Young, who those who are familiar with EPMD are familiar with the productions of Kerwin Young, and those who are familiar with Chinese composition. He was a student of Chin Yi at the Conservatory of Music and Dance. So I'm just absolutely stoked that I was able to get some of his music.
Can you back up and tell me a little bit more about what crump in particular has?
I can tell you what crump has taught me. Crump has further strengthened my ability to tell my story and to find value in my self-worth. And I am so fortunate, and I think the whole world is fortunate, that we have such a street dance, such a movement art that is explicit within in its foundation, which is about you finding self-worth and self-satisfaction, whatever, within your story, within how you feel, what you're thinking at that time and moment, which we all understand is a strong composite, a foundational aspect of being an artist in general, but is not necessarily always explicitly taught. And in crump, it is an explicit part of learning crump.
Can you explain that?
How it's an
explicit part of the
meaning dance, like you cannot get into crump without having gone through that, like, period. That's first class, first session, outdoors, indoors. They're telling you that this is about storytelling. It is about your story and you finding value in your story from the get-go. It's not something that the teacher tells you later.
Kat Mahari, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Kat's performance solo mixtape series, part 2, Violence Break, is at 35th and Woodland this Thursday and includes a community movement class. That's a really cool opportunity. And you can find out more about it on Facebook. Mm-hmm. Up next, 3 local sculptors on the International Sculpture Conference coming to Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. There's an international sculpture conference convening in Kansas City this week. So now we're going to consider where the art form is headed. And honestly, it would probably be simpler to ask where it is not headed, because what we consider sculpture in 2017 goes beyond physical materials. It challenges our assumption that a sculpture is something that lasts, something you can point to and put a label on. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with 3 local artists, and their practices demonstrate just how hard to pin down the art form really is. I want to start with Karen McCoy, an environmental sculptor who turns landscapes into art. Hi, Karen.
Hey.
So, environmental sculpture, for the uninitiated, what is it?
Well, what a question. So it could be considered a relative of the early form, which with earthworks. But now we think of it in other terms, perhaps interventions, perhaps site-specific sculpture that's made for a particular place, and the artist might be doing very deep research on the history of that place, geologically or culturally. Research might include things that you would expect, like reading, but it might also include walking or talking to people that live there, or even field work, like digging to see what the earth looks like, research on how people have lived there in the past, things like that.
Can you give an example of a project that you have done that you think incorporates some interesting research that you might like to tell us about?
Well, I could go on and on about that, but I'll say perhaps a project that's called Consuming Questions, which began because I witnessed a landslide when I was on sabbatical leave in Italy a few years ago. There was a landslide right next to the property where I was in residence at the Bogliasco Foundation. And I began to ask what caused this, because the people living there said, these houses have been here perched on the edge of the Mediterranean for hundreds of years, and the water is now moving in mysterious ways. So I began to translate articles from the local papers and meet people that were working on the problem. And I also began to walk uphill to see what was going on. And I could see that where they had had agrarian terraces for hundreds of years, there were taking down the dry stone walls that held back the earth for vineyards and olive groves and allowed the water that hit the earth to slowly seep. And they were putting in roads. Everyone wanted to get to their house up in the hills with a car now, not walk up there. Can understand that. They were taking out the agrarian groves and putting in condos and hard surfaces. And it was all affecting how the water was running downhill.
What did you learn from your feet? I mean, you talked about walking uphill as part of your research.
Well, I could see what was happening, for one thing, and I would meet people and I would say, so we had a landslide, what do you think is going on? And I met an elderly gentleman in his 90s, and his name was Siri, and he said, all the young people are leaving the farms and going to the cities. We have that here in the United States as well.
So how did this become something that you would call sculpture?
Right. So I began to do drawings. I had a tiny space. I often make drawings with earth pigments that I find while walking. And I was using those pigments to make egg tempera and pouring these large drawings that were, inspired by witnessing that landslide and those people locked out of their homes.
So when you say you poured drawings, can you describe that in a little more detail?
Yeah, so you mix your pigment with your eggs and some water, and the pigment is actually soil color that I would find while walking. And I have pieces of paper, and I literally take the cup and make pours, and I can move the paper. I collect the pigment or it just falls on the table or the floor. And that's how they're made. But so I'm controlling the consistency, the pace, and there's a lot of accident. And I'm also, keeping my eye on it and sort of coaxing the parts that I like and maybe moving the pigment in other places if I don't like what's going on.
So this is on some level inspired by the landslide.
Precisely. How the earth would move down the hillside and what the scar looked like.
Can you describe the scar?
Yeah. So it was filled with debris from the houses, mostly from the terraces. This was a small landslide. If you do research online, there are horrendous landslides. I think we all know that. We've been seeing them on television when there are floods and so on, in Colorado, for example, or in the Pacific Northwest. So it's just this sort of ugly scar, and the earth is the raw earth is exposed. It no longer has the plant life on it. And you can see it falling, in this case, into the Mediterranean. So you could see this sort of red pool of soil right at the shoreline.
There are cases where your work has been more built into the landscape than inspired by it. Can you describe some of that work?
Say a piece that I made called Uprooted. I made it in Denmark just as I was moving from Massachusetts to Kansas City in 1994. And we literally uprooted four trees with the help of a forester. And I learned to thatch. That's how people make their roofs oftentimes in Denmark still. And so this structure was kind of an homage to the craft of making houses out of wood and out of a renewable resource like the grasses that are used to make thatch roofs. And it was also a bit of a self-portrait as I was feeling kind of uprooted before I came here and put down new roots.
Sustainability is a big issue in the world, but also in the world of sculpture. And in fact, it's one of the conference topics coming up. Can you talk about how sustainability fits into your practice?
Well, it's interesting that you asked. The panel that I'm moderating at ISC is called Strategies for a Sustainable Practice. And there are four of us on the panel, and we've been talking by phone over the last weeks of the summer and into the fall. And we're all really beginning to question in a more general sense if sustainable activities are becoming outmoded, and what is now needed is more a sense of resiliency.
As in, like, not just sustaining, but like building back what's already been lost?
Something like that, or responding to loss. To loss of species, to loss of habitat through toxic situations, and the whole sense that as human beings living on the planet, we've gone too far.
You know, the Earth as your inspiration, as your materials, as in some ways a canvas. This might all sound to some people as, like, hippie stuff.
I don't think so. I think it's the way of the future. I want to come back to this landslide as a source for sculpture and talk about a piece that's now up at the Surplus Exchange and is made of consumer goods. I asked people to give me consumer goods that were cast off that they no longer needed. And this is originally it was made for the Steamboat Arabia Museum, and then it moved to Surplus Exchange, and it's going to move to the Nerman Museum of Contemporary Art in November. It's 40 feet long, or about to become 40 feet long. It has been 28 feet long. And it's a landslide or an avalanche of consumer goods coated in Missouri red subsoil. And it is really about consumerism and the relationship of each of our habits to the larger picture on Earth.
Okay, Karen McCoy, hang out with me for a second, because I want to see if there's a connecting thread or not between you and one of our other guests this morning, okay?
Thank you.
Fatima Tugar, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So your work deals, I mean, Karen's, I think it's safe to say there's, like, it's in the world of the tangible. It lives very much there. And you deal with the world of technology, which takes you far beyond the tangible at times.
Well, it starts with the tangible and then moves beyond that into both virtual reality and currently I'm working with the Davis Museum in Boston, the Boston area, doing a piece in augmented reality. So yes, it does move from objects, which usually the objects are assemblage kind of objects where I use traditional mixes. I'm originally from Western Africa. So I would use a traditional tool and an untraditional tool, combine the two to speak to the idea of how there's a toggling back and forth that goes on in cultures where electricity, the infrastructure isn't stable. And then I've moved beyond that into the virtual because I'm interested also in, you know, the reason, I guess it's important to point out to the larger sort of question that you're asking, the reason why that would be considered sculpture is that it's a 360 experience. It isn't a flat 2D experience. And I think the reason why sculpture has sort of blown out and expanded into multiple directions has to do with its counterpart, the relationship of sculpture and painting, which is sort of the historical relationship. So if you're as old as I am, when you go to school and you want to work beyond the sculptural, before there was mixed media or digital media programs, you went into sculpture, which allowed you to do sound, which allowed you to do anything else that you wanted to do.
Sculpture. Why does sculpture allow you to do, it seems like, almost anything, truly?
Because it's not two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional, and we live in a three-dimensional realm, so it's broad in that way. So like with the 3D augmented reality pieces, where you see objects that manifest in three-dimensional context, you know, the piece that I'm currently working on called Deep Blue Wells, which is to do with the tie-dye wells and sort of reconnecting back to Karen's point, is sort of how the craft of tie-dye is becoming extinct.
It is?
Yes, it is, for two reasons. One is younger people don't apprentice with their parents to become tie-dye artists. And also everybody wants to move to the cities. So as a result, the generation of my parents, once those people are gone, nobody will be doing these kinds of crafts. The other is, of course, the presence of China in Africa. So they are bringing already made fabrics that mimic the traditional. So that takes over. So I'm doing this piece to talk about how this has like a long-standing history, and perhaps that it's worth revisiting and rethinking how we can sustain it, maybe using other technologies, or how we can adapt part of it and archive it so that people can learn about it.
Fatima Tugar, when we come back from the break, I want to hear more of your story, okay?
Thank you.
And we'll also hear from Dwight Frizzell, who makes sculpture out of sound. So stick around for more Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. We've been talking with Karen McCoy and Fatima Tugar about their art practices. They're both sculptors, but whereas Karen's work deals with the earth and its materials, Fatima starts there and takes us into virtual and augmented realities, and I still don't entirely know what that is, so we'll have to get there. Fatima, tell us a little bit more about your background and what brought you to the kind of art that you pursue.
So I was born in Western Africa, and then I in northern part of Nigeria, and then I grew up there and in the UK back and forth. And as a result, you can see why I would combine an electric mixer and the traditional bluegiri to make a new object, or I would combine a 1957 radio, but then embed a chip in it to tell stories that are in the tradition of oral storytelling. So it's sort of the life that I've lived, I guess, becomes the reason why I work the way that I do with the materials that I know. And then, of course, I moved from London to Kansas City, from Kansas City then to New Haven, Connecticut, and then to New York.
So you've lived a lot of places.
Yes.
Where even just the word technology, which is the subject that you're speaking on in the panel this coming week, the word technology means different things in those different contexts too, I'm guessing.
Yes. Well, I use that word not to just mean computer stuff, which is, I think, generally we think of the digital as technology, I think of earlier technologies, you know, so objects we make, the impact of electricity, the radio, you know, these are all older technologies, but they are definitely technologies that we use.
Can you tell me about a sculpture that exists in a virtual or augmented reality and how and what makes it sculptural to you, the specific?
Okay. So my first virtual reality piece is called Desired Dwellings. It's a piece that I made while I was a research fellow at the Franklin Humanities Institute at Duke. And it is a piece that deals with different living situations. So anything from like there's a situation where when you walk into the piece and you put on the 3D goggles and then you have like a kind of Wii remote that you hold onto and you're really standing still, but you can move in space by seeing what is going on. Like you can move through the space. So you could find yourself in this cardboard box and examine what it feels like to live in a cardboard box. And then perhaps you can move through. I was lucky that the United Nations Human Rights Archive images are housed at Duke. So I had access to those. So I picked the war in Liberia and used the materials, those photographs, to create a circumstance where what it would feel like if your house was blown up and you're living in this sort of dilapidated space.
When you say what it feels like, I guess that's an interesting thing to me because I think of understanding what something feels like through senses of like feeling the air on my skin or feeling the ground under my body or something like that. And that's not quite the kind of sensing that you do using a Wii remote.
It's not, but if you're encompassed, when you look down, you can see what the ground looks like. If you look up, you can see the roof is blown off and you're seeing the sky. And if you look to the left, you see holes from gunshots in the wall. I think it's as close as you're going to get. And if you can hear the sound of people in a distance, either yelling, screaming, or firing or more bombings, I think it puts you closer than when you're watching a movie and you're watching Private Ryan on a flat screen and looking, and you know you're outside of that context. But if you're enveloped and surrounded by both sound and images, I think it's a different sort of experience.
Even a different experience than it would be if you put a cardboard box right in front of me in Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah.
I want to, while you're talking about being surrounded by sound, speak with our third sculptor this morning, Dwight Frizzell. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And so you build sculptures that are invisible.
They're invisible, but we can hear them. And when you hear the sounds of materials, it leaves an imprint about what the materials are, just like keys. Metal sounds like metal because of its overtone structure, or wood. Can barely hear it in the background, being more porous and having the fibers in it it's going to sound like wood. So sound sculpture is sound art that never forgets the world, that never forgets the source of sound. And that might include soundscape and either urban or ecological, environmental, in natural or wilderness areas. So those are some considerations of sound art and sound sculpture.
Do you think of it as building with a physical material? I mean, people who work with sound are using sort of, I mean, sound is physical, but is that what makes it sculpture or something else?
It's a little different. I don't build sculptures through sound in the traditional way, in terms of, say, self-expression. I'm interested in different kinds of, consciousness, or I look at things like the whole world is living. So, for example, this project I'm working on, Bridge, which is using a Missouri River bridge as an instrument. It's the bridge at 291 Highway out east of Independence, Missouri. Well, as I was growing up, I used to frequent that bridge in that area. There's a wonderful park there. And I put my ear up against the bridge. and it's traffic-activated sound that moves all across the bridge. Of course, you get the sound of traffic, so you get this kind of rhythmical sound of cars and trucks and all of that. But then there are also these metal pipes that run all the way across the bridge. And somehow the sound resonates through them. And as it resonates, it creates a periodic sound. It sounds like voices. It sounds like it's singing, like a choir. It's so beautiful. So,
I think I know what you mean. There's kind of like almost a moaning.
Yes. Yes. And this bridge is particularly good at it. So in working on this project, I'm not composing music for the bridge and going and beating on it, you know, like a composer would do. It's all based on listening to the world and discovering it. And in the bridge and in that sound, we hear the sound of human movement. We hear the sound of people moving from one side to the other. I listen to it as a kind of living system or a living thing. It's very similar to what the Missouri Regional Council is doing now with MoDOT. They're doing a big project where they're analyzing the Broadway Bridge downtown. And they look at the bridge as how it functions. So they're looking at it as not only people as agents moving across it, but how it connects communities, how it creates economic exchange.
But I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Karen, which is how does this research become something you would call a sculpture?
It becomes a sculpture in the sense that it's contextualized into a kind of performative space that people can come inside and experience within the context of art. For example, the Bridge Project, when it's performed, it looked like next September, it looks like when it's going to be performed. If you can imagine being inside the bridge is scaled to a large auditorium space so that when you hear traffic go across it, you can hear it behind you and move across you through the whole space to the other side. You also hear the singing of the tones moving in the space. And then with the audience will be the musicians in this particular piece. They're playing these metal bowls. They're like the singing bowls, the Tibetan singing bowls. And it's very composed in the sense that the certain bowls that match certain frequencies in the sound will be played at certain times. And it pulls the sound between the speakers and the bowl. So you'll hear it moving around the space. Audience can move around the entire space. And we start to think about it as a kind of living thing with, yes.
What do you think that you understand about the experience of being in this city, for example, and being near this bridge and what it feels like and what it means to the city? What do you think you understand about it by removing yourself from that setting and recreating the experience?
You gain a way to reconsider the bridge itself, how it functions. When we drive across the bridge, we want to get to the other side. We're going somewhere. We don't stop.
Usually.
Yeah. I hope so. I know sometimes I drive a little faster across a bridge because I see the river down there. And I like, I want to get on the other side. But when we put it in this different context, a time to kind of relax, lose ourselves in sound. Sound sort of melts objects away. They lose their boundary. Now they're not only 3D, they're in 4D, and they surround us. And so it helps. It's quite fun and entertaining. We consider it in a different way, in a different context.
In a less busy, kind of preoccupied way.
Absolutely.
You know, something that I'm curious for both you, Dwight, and you, Fatima, is the idea of sculpture as a thing that you could, that lasts, that you can go visit in a place anytime. That doesn't seem to be entirely the nature of what you're doing. I mean, if you think of really like the bronze monument or something, it lives in a place and you go and visit it. And that's not entirely what a virtual reality is, or is it? Do you think of that the same way?
Well, in some way, it is prominent in the sense that if you have the code, you can still go experience the piece, right? So, you know, I've never been to Japan, and one of the parts of Desired Dwellings is a sort of high-tech Japanese home that has a toilet that washes your bum. So, like, it would be in essence, if you can take the code and find another space, you can reassemble the piece. And I think what makes it also sculpture is the fact that we are dealing with questions about three-dimensionality of space. So anything that in terms of process, if you don't understand X, Y, Z coordinates, you will not be able to build that space.
It's like the code is a map that takes you to a place.
Yes, right? So you can always take the code, you can reassemble it anywhere. That makes it that. As far as it being like a monument or other sculptural objects, I guess saleability becomes an issue. Is not necessarily the most easy thing to sell.
I will sell you a trip to a cardboard box in a virtual reality.
Yeah, so saleability isn't really the reason why you do it. Temporality, it becomes sort of part of the nature of the work. And then also, I think that if we don't question the three-dimensionality of how architects work, we cannot question the three-dimensionality of VR because, right, if you're making sculpture, the way we are taught is that you do these technical drawings that talk about the three-dimensionality of space before ever building something. So from that perspective, I guess it is still part of the same extended kind of practice. You know, the only difference in the way that I work with 3D virtual reality or augmented reality is that I actually use the skin, the surface that you see is not rendered. It's photo-based. So that also gives it a different kind of look. It doesn't look like a finished drawing when it's rendered.
Dwight, can people go back to visit your sculptures again? Or does, you know, once you've been in attendance and you leave?
Well, they are, I think, experiences. They're designed for you to have, in a sense, your own experience. So sometimes they're products are made and distributed, like CDs or other ways to experience it. But in the space of it, it happens sort of in time. So it's I set it up for you or an audience to really to have their own experiences and drive the bus rather than be me. This is my expression. You're supposed to get it. It's more about your own experience.
Karen, your works, which are centered in actual, they are about places and they are in places on the earth. You know, that seems like a very big part of what you do. Is it important to you, the idea of going to a place as part of what it means to experience your sculpture?
Well, yes, but I mean, I think for one thing, like what Dwight is saying, for example, memory and experience live within each of us, even if we've gone to the Nelson to see the Henry Moores. You know, we take them away in our memory. Yeah, I recently made a sculpture of river silt from the Missouri River at the Healthy Rivers Partnership, and it was stabilized with sorghum syrup from sorghum grown north of Kansas City. And when I was ready to take the sculpture away, it left a trace on the floor, and I was ready to scrub that up. And they said, no, no, please leave it. We want to keep that river's trace here. So the sculpture itself is gone, but there's this residue. And I think that is almost like a metaphor for what you might experience seeing Fatima's work or hearing Dwight's. It lingers.
Our time is up, but Karen McCoy, Fatima Tugar, and Dwight Frizzell, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gina. For
information on the conference and presentations going on as part of the International Sculpture Conference, head to sculpture.org/KC2017. You can listen back to all of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.